This is Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Here are your hosts, Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Johnny Lupinacci, educated educators talking education.
There it is, Monday. Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Educated educators talking education. Right away, the number is 855-752-4842. You know, it's on a Monday. Somebody out there with some eagerness, jump in, give us a call right away. What do you want to talk about? Education, public education, democracy, advocacy, you name it, Johnny Lupinacci. We do it. The thing is we are, you know, right now, we are, as far as we know, the only five-day-a-week commercial radio show dedicated to public education and democracy right now. Just wanting to put that out there so that people go, wait, what's this, Busted Pencils? Busted Pencils, man, it is a daily radio show where we get to talk about public education, democracy, teaching, learning, Friday night football maybe even too, all kinds of things coming up. But man, telling about it. And even in Finland, we talk about this in Finland. How do people in Finland hear about us, Johnny? The Civic Media app, dude. You know that.
Well, yeah, man. I'm just like, I mean, there's people all over the country, all over Wisconsin, right, listening to. It doesn't just pop from your local terrestrial radio station to Finland. It's an odd hour of the day in Finland. But yes, the Civic Media app is a wonderful way to tune into all your civic media programming. I guess while we're talking about all these things, Tim, we got a big week ahead of us.
Oh, we do.
Coming off of, we're still reeling from the DNC. Lots to talk about. All kinds of exciting action from educators that'll be participating in the show this week. We'll preview and sneak a little bit of that. But hey, just a reminder for listeners, this is the season. I mean, it's really always the season in a democracy, but this is a big one. Right. Mm-hmm. It's like the playoffs leading to the championship in November. Be a voter. Tuesday, September 17th is National Voter Registration Day. Plan to check your voter registration and be sure you're ready for November 5th. I mean, that's the big game. You were talking about Friday night football, but
oh yeah,
I mean, Friday night football is always going to be here. We're going to talk a lot about how those kinds of, stalwarts of our community are part of public education for sure. But man, when you start talking about public education as the bedrock for a democracy, and what do we do in a democracy?
Mm-hmm.
Besides, you know, offer our civic duty towards a government for the people, by the people. But one of our main things, like one of our feature activities, is we vote. It doesn't just mean we go out and vote on voting day. There's all kinds of getting good information, having great conversations, asking tough questions. Looking for transparency, honesty, accountability, right? Looking at policies and then saying, hey, it's time to go do our duty. Mm-hmm. And part of that is to make sure we're registered. So voter registration, National Voter Registration Day, September 17th. Get out and vote. Mm-hmm. I always like campaigns, rock the vote. Because we're rocking here at Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk.
Tim, I got to tell you one of the things. I'm so excited. I just got in the mail today. My daughter, who is away at college full time, she did what she's supposed to do without me even telling her. She signed up for her absentee ballot and the fact that she can vote by mail. I got all of that today. I was like, I called her up. I was like, Lace, what's going on? She goes, oh, yeah, Dad, I took care of that. I went awesome. And did what I had to do. And I was just like, yeah, but those are the examples we talk about. It's like, hey, guess what? If you're away, you too can vote. There are absentee ballots. Vote by mail. Figure it out. What you said, go and dig that information. Johnny, look at that right away, though, too, as we put out the call asking for calls. Cindy from Appleton right away jumping in before we even get to the stuff. Cindy from Appleton, what's going on? What's your question? What's happening in your world?
Well, I'm a little concerned because remember what happened with Hillary and the criminal the first time around?
Mm-hmm.
He won the popular vote. He won the Electoral College vote. And I'm very concerned that that could happen again.
Could.
Are you worried, though, about that from the standpoint of what we said, like low voter turnout? Or are you concerned? I mean, what is the issue? Because,
well, maybe that's something you guys should educate people about, is the Electoral College and how it works. because I myself am not sure how it works. All I know is whoever gets the most votes wins the Electoral College, or electoral votes. But to be honest with you, how they gather all these votes, I'm still a little rusty on. So that might be a topic for conversation.
Thank you, Cindy.
I love that. That's a great question. And that's true, because it is kind of, I mean, we could talk about it and we can get into it, but it is certainly not logical when you think about how fair voting ought to really be, right? You think about, hey, you vote for a representative, the popular vote counts, right? But the Electoral College, I think, Tim, probably you and I both agree, needs to go away. But it's there in place, and it's there in place for exactly like Cindy was bringing up, to kind of be, it's supposed to be a safeguard. Is that what we might call it, Tim? Like they say, it's a safeguard.
It's the protection against it's the protection against the uninformed masses voting too much.
Right. So let me give a little quick definition of the Electoral College, because I think Cindy is right. We should talk about this because, one, we have some trauma around it. We've been hey, the majority of the voters have voted, but yet that's not that didn't determine the winner. What happened? You know, one of those. It's happened a few times in my voting lifetime where I've gone to bed pretty excited because I didn't exactly know exactly how the Electoral College worked the first time. Remember that? Remember that Al Gore election, Tim? And it was like a totally different, I had to check my, you know, self, pinch myself and be like, wait, am I still sleeping? Did something happen? It sure did. But we can get into it. But the quick kind of way to think about it is the Electoral College consists of 538 electors, right? A majority of 270 electoral votes is required to elect a president.
Mm.
Different states, right? So your state has the same number of electors as it does members in its congressional delegation. So you have one member in the House of Representatives plus two senators, one for each member in the House of Representatives plus two senators, right? So the states have different numbers of electoral, what do we call it? Electoral voters?
Electors.
So different states have different numbers of electors, and there are 538 total electors. And the majority of 270 electoral votes is required to elect the president. So you're asking, why is Johnny saying this? Because don't we go and vote and they count up all the votes, right? That's why we see the state map when the election's going on, right? Because they're going to say, hey, this state has gone to this candidate, this ticket, and that means this many electoral votes.
Mm-hmm.
Our individual votes contribute towards possible electoral votes on the table, right? And so Cindy's call is really important because, man, high population areas could be swinging a particular way and go a particular way and not necessarily determine the presidential election because it's determined on electoral votes. Now, if it's a blue wave, let's call it that, or what do we want to say? If it's a brat election, right? Then we got nothing to worry about because it's not close. If it's close, this is where the Electoral College, and this is what Cindy, I think, is referring to, has had a different outcome than the popular individual votes. And this is why so many people, myself included, say things like, I think this Electoral College thing has got to go. Because you can't say we are a democracy. The people have voted. It's clear, right? It's not even like we need a recount. It's that close. It's clear.
Absolutely.
And that didn't do enough electoral voting. Electoral College is one way, and I'm going to go a little opinion, a little off fact, is one way to rig an election, but not quite rig an election. It's just like in there. In case it's close, don't worry.
It's a subversion. It's a subversion of democracy in that sense when you're talking about popular democracy. And
well, we should do more about it, Tim. Like, so we'll continue to talk about the Electoral College because we do all have some trauma around it. Thanks, Cindy, for calling and bringing it up. We got L.A. Tom on the horn. I bet you he could tell us, too, about the Electoral College. What's up, Tom? You love the Electoral College?
Well, first off, guys, I'm a joyful democracy warrior, just like our soon-to-be president and vice president are. And I would like to say that, you know, the other guy is just not a serious candidate for the presidency, and we really need to be honest about that. He's not serious about democracy. He's only serious about Project 2025 and him being a dictator. And I would recommend everyone watch The Handmaid's Tale if you want to see your future if we get him in office, because that's really what it's going to look like. Yeah, in terms of the Electoral College, we need to get rid of the Electoral College.
There it is.
States like California, which are the, you know, the largest state in the union, and it doesn't even really matter which way our votes go, which is really quite ridiculous. Also, like Johnny was saying, you know, basically it's the number of House representatives that you have and your two senators that make up the number that comes to the electoral number of votes. And that can change every 10 years because of the census if people don't actually sign up with the census.
There it is. You know, right there, a little extra added to that, Johnny Lupinacci, your little civics lesson. Yeah. And that is, hey, guess what? Social studies educators, we always will dig deep into this. So Cindy, L.A. Tom, thanks for the call. It's really getting us started off on that, Johnny.
So let's play a game real quick, because this is fun. I like to do that anytime we're learning. We had a great recap of that from L.A. Tom, the Electoral College, right? Allocations are based on the census. So it is based on, right, the populations and states, right? So how are electors determined, right? So we said that we had that kind of formula, right, of how they were determined, but how does it become unequal, right? So how many are in California? How many votes, Tim, we know California has? 54 votes, right?
Right.
So California gets 54 votes. So at the end of, right, at the end of the elections tallied up, they say California's gone this way. That's 54, right? Possible electoral votes based, but it's a little more complicated because it carves up into sections. But let's talk about, for listener out there, because a lot of you are in the great state of Wisconsin. How many electoral votes are in Wisconsin?
John Lupinacci, that's a good question right now to kind of keep people on this, on their seats right there.
I mean, I know the listeners know. If you don't, you're going to find out. Stay tuned. How many electoral votes are in the state of Wisconsin?
Love Mondays, busted pencils, fully leaded education talk. The black flag there. Educated educators talking education. 855-752-4842. Johnny, looks like we might have, you know, created a little bit of a learning opportunity right now for the listener. Yeah, Cindy, thanks for getting this. Keith.
It's a great topic, too. What's up, Keith?
Keith, what's happening?
Hey, good afternoon, guys. I just wanted to throw something else out there, too, as far as the population of the states and representation. The big factor there is our senators. We each get two senators per state, whether we're California with, you know, 80 million people, or we're Wyoming with 80,000 people. So that brings into a big problem when we have, at least for us Democrats right now, the last 20 years, when we have all of a sudden lost the Supreme Court drastically because there's just, we don't have the as far as dominating the Senate, we don't have a big enough a majority, and with the filibuster, we can't get those things passed. So even a little state like Wyoming can be very, very important when they have two senators. So population is important.
Kate, Keith, Johnny, in fact, population is so important. Johnny, the question is, we were coming out, though, to Wisconsin. How many electors Wisconsin, Johnny? Uh-oh, Sherry. Sherry says 9 from Wisconsin. 9 for Wisconsin. Johnny Lupinacci.
I thought it was 10, but that's off the top of my head, and I don't know it. I haven't looked up at for this election. It may have changed since the last big election when I was looking at what Wisconsin counted for. Let's type it in. Jess, let's do it. Let's figure it out. How many electors are in the state of Wisconsin?
10.
Good state of Wisconsin. All right, I was right. 10. Okay. Sherry, you were close. 9, right? That's pretty big. But I like what our caller, was it Keith, brought up.
Yeah.
You know, he gave also that example of Wyoming. Why I pulled Wyoming and Texas is that that's the largest disparity. You have this highly populated state, Texas, right, with electors. And then you have, you know, Wyoming, which is the least populated state ratio to electors. And so you have this huge gap, and where, you know, Keith was saying these small states can really swing an election. Now, that's partly, to be fair, I mean, again, I'm saying like the Electoral College has got to go already, all right? But some of the argument for it is that has been made the case that small states were given this kind of power, that it was, this is not by mistake, right?
Right.
It's actually, you know, given to them to prevent politicians from only focusing on issues which affects the larger states, right? So this is an effort to balance things, which is kind of what you do in democracy. You try and figure out the best way to do these things.
Really?
And when you find out that they're pretty flawed, then you say, come on, we're better than this. We have the great human capacity to have wild things like electric trucks that look like dumpster tanks. We could figure out a better way to do elections. You know, I'm just saying that because I'm staring out my studio window, and I just saw one of those fancy electric dumpster trucks go by. You know what I'm talking about? I refuse to say the company's name. Not that I really have anything against that company, but I'm not always too excited about the guy behind the business. But I digress. Come back to it, right? In efforts to kind of balance power, that is why the Electoral College is there, or the electoral vote kind of exists. You know, the idea would be then politicians would just completely ignore Wyoming and they'd spend all their time in Texas, or they'd be in California, right? And they wouldn't come out to, you know, Iowa, Nebraska, and other places. So all the states in the country matter. And so in efforts to kind of balance that, that's why it's there. But as Cindy reminds us, it is not just a popular vote. And just to recap, we were comparing Texas and Wyoming. For example, like Texas, right, has one elector for just about every, you know, 700 to 800,000 people. Wyoming has one elector for every 150,000, 170,000 people. You see, like, if you're in Wyoming voting, your vote, every 150,000 so people's vote goes to one elector.
You're a big
versus in Texas, you got to get up like 750,000, 800,000 votes to get that electoral move. Now, is there a perfect way to do this? No. Has the Electoral College been a problem? Yes. So a lot of us do say, hey, let's get rid of it. Let's go to a popular vote. I am not even sure that's the solution. All I know is that here's what I hope for, folks. A big landslide. Like, this election is a no-brainer. Gather your facts. Figure out where you stand on things. Vote how you vote. But if you're supporters of education, period, public education especially, but education, period, it's kind of a no-brainer, right? You got one ticket that wants to do away with it, and another ticket that's saying like, hey, let's try and make it better. Seems like a no-brainer for us educators out there. Although we still got to talk about all the policies. We're still going to contrast things, because we do need to kind of make sure we're focused on, you know, the big issues, making sure we're getting that information. And especially as it translates and transcends to trending things in education. Tim,
Well, first of all, the Busted Pencils fully leaded education talk. Yeah, we're the educated educators talking education. In fact, making that transition, Johnny Lupinacci, here's a big major study out last week from our friends at the Fordham Foundation. Johnny, you're not gonna believe this, but hey, according to a study by the Fordham Foundation that is reported in K-12 Dive, there might be. And in fact, in their study, they seem like there seems to be some inclusion that the achievement gap has a connection to poverty in some way, shape, or form, that poverty has an influence in the achievement gap. Now, people are out there going, yes, this is Tim's sarcasm. Johnny, we know anybody out there, you do not have to call in to help Johnny through this sarcastic moment. He got it right away. He understood that we're making
sometimes. I get distracted because you said Fordham and I said, how much do we need to be able to afford them? I don't know.
And then we were
talking about poverty, and it was more about what you can't afford and what you can't afford.
No,
and so the Fordham Institute, is this what you're talking about?
Fordham Institute, who is largely for the most part a cheerleader for what is called education reform that we've talked about over the last 40 years, long history of advocating. In fact, advocating poverty don't matter, nothing, man. We need to get rid of those bad teachers. We need to get rid of bad curriculum. We need to get rid of bad books, all of those things. Because, man, if you got rid of all of that stuff, you would actually make a difference in the achievement gap. Well, here it is now in 2024. The Fordham Foundation seems like they may have come across some research findings in their own research
To be clear, as we go through this, because Tim, I didn't get stuck on the sarcasm, but as you know, I'm kind of a fan of the Jesuit schools, and I know about Fordham, and I just want to separate Fordham Institute, Thomas B. Fordham Institute, think tank, Ohio policy, that kind of business, separated out from the Jesuit institution, the Fordham University, right? And that's then where now you got, if you got them, you can afford them. Then let's go. Let's get back to it. When we're here, Busted Pencils, we'll unpack this some more.
It's Buster Pencils. It's fully leaded education talk. It's truly educated educators talking education. Got a lot of participation right away. Cindy, L.A., Tom, Keith calling in. Yeah, we were talking about the Electoral College. We're moving on to that, though, kind of talking about new findings out of the Fordham Institute, not to be confused with Fordham University, the Jesuit institution in New York City. But, guess what? It comes out right now, and poverty, or they don't call it poverty in their research, they call socioeconomic factors may influence the academic achievement gap.
Yeah, they weren't willing to go all the way and say does. They said, right. Well, it wasn't fully conclusive, but socioeconomic factors might influence academic outcomes.
In fact, if you read very much all the way to the end, one of the most strongest indicators they point out is parental income, which the last time I checked, parental income has something to do with poverty.
Yeah, typically. Most kids aren't bringing home the family income. We hope that they aren't.
Right. So the fact that how much money your parents make and the education of your mom, throw those two together, which are, guess what? Those are truly socioeconomic indicators, or potentially saying, and when you don't have a lot of socioeconomic indicators, such as high parental income and high parental or mother college attainment, guess what happens? The achievement gap, particularly for the racial achievement gap for Black, white, and Hispanic students, gets expanded, Johnny Lupinacci.
Yeah, here's the thing, Fordham, sorry, a little bit too little, way too late. We've known this we have evidence, we have research evidence for decades now, and it goes longer than that.
Right.
That socioeconomics factors. And I'm going to say that's also code language for like what Tim's talking about, like the systemic way poverty exists in this country, the lack of access to healthcare, the living in food, you know, food deserts, the lack, you know, the young people who don't have access, young animal people who don't have healthcare access, mm-hmm. right? The ways that we fail communities, right? So that's like, it's socioeconomic is just like kind of an uppity fancy way, right? That distances us from the real ways people are suffering in communities that are intersectional, that are very very based oftentimes in this country on race, on gender, right? And on the systems of poverty that so many young children are born into, right? So, but for decades and decades, I can remember when I was first becoming a teacher 20 some years ago, I had a professor and you could tell him the family income of a household and he could tell you within a tenth of a point what that student would get on their ACT and SAT. He had mathematical algorithms that could give you the, you input an income and then combined family income out of a household, put it into the computer, right down to the last kind of thing. He can tell you exactly what that kid's score is, know nothing about them, never have looked at their grades, and be accurate to within a tenth of a point. So this is the way that like we know, we have known for a really long time, it doesn't really matter who you are, right? The systems are stacked in a way where you have, if you're born into poverty, you have uphill the whole way. You have no opportunity to pick yourself up from the bootstraps, as so the myth might tell. The system is designed. Now, occasionally, like winning the lotto, people make it. And do they work hard? They sure do, Tim. So I don't want to take that away from those folks, mm-hmm. or listener out there who's like, man, wait, I was poor when I was young and I've worked really hard. I wouldn't exactly call myself not poor now. Like I think most people in America probably listening aren't exactly identifying as billionaires, millionaires, or you know, wealthy to say, but they sure worked hard. But it doesn't work for everyone. In fact, if you are at a disadvantage when you're born or in the community you're in, you will likely stay at or go lower than that level in this country. And that's a sad thing. So a little bit too little, way too late, boredom. And sorry, doesn't annul you of your sins in my book. Some of us who are familiar with it. Oh man, what's that? That's the Democracy in Action bell every day at the same time at the 40-minute mark in the hour. We ring the bell, and that signals that we are going to award the Democracy in Action Award. Today's Democracy in Action Award, you know what? It goes to everybody who values justice.
Mm.
That's working not too little, not too late, right? So I know there are a lot of people out there say, cut them some slack. The Fordham Institute is finally agreeing with us. Well, I'll tell you what, the us way back then, and it wasn't even me, it's generations before me who were saying, you know what, this is systemic. Poverty matters and we can do something about it. And when we do something about it, it changes lives. It improves our entire country. And it starts oftentimes at education and healthcare and early childhood, you know, kinds of ways. And to systemically ignore that, especially and to ignore that in marginalized communities, I hate that term. It should be people who have been excluded from the power and privilege that the political majority has held for far too long. But, you know, we often refer to those as minority groups. Don't like that language, but that'll help identify. Have suffered disproportionately and are more likely to experience factors of poverty. So Fordham, a little bit too little, a little bit too late. So Democracy in Action Award, you know, those are core democratic values that support democracy. Go to everybody who was justice the whole way. Now, tiny little violin playing for poor Fordham, who's
saying, hey, you know,
what about us? What about us? We're seeing it finally. Say, okay, we hear you. And I like this, though. Our producer just reminded us, hey, a step in the right direction is a step.
It's a so good one. It's a good
credit,
one.
Credit to it.
But you know, Johnny, you pointed out too the prediction ability of socioeconomic. And just a reminder for people, we have had on the show Christopher Tenken from Seton Hall, who has really come in to say, you want to know what your test scores are going to be? all he needs are a few socioeconomic factors, very much like you said, Johnny, and his ability to predict the test scores before the students take the tests. He can do that without knowing anything other than a few socioeconomic factors. I think that is really, you know, again, pointing that out. But, you know, the other part here, too, is that we talk about this often. How do you make sense of media? You know, and this is one of those things, the education media here, Johnny. And the title of this article, I'm going to put the title out here, Socioeconomic Factors Partially at Play in Racial Achievement Gaps. Partially at play. So you can hear right there, there's kind of this hedging. Oh, I don't know, maybe. All the way to the end of the article, though, the findings. Household income was the biggest contributor to the Black-White achievement gap. Okay, so how do you go from the income, household income being the biggest, and you have a headline, Jess, that says, well, partially.
I mean, technically, Tim, 90% is partial.
I guess this is one of those where you're just like, you're kidding me, right? And typically, so this kind of means also comes a little bit of a critique for K-12 Dive, who put this out there. They're the ones who titled this piece from, you know, and again, the research they're citing is coming out of the Fordham Foundation. And I know the Fordham Foundation probably said, hey, can you give us a title that's a little bit more up our alley? You know, I mean, socioeconomic partially at play. Hey, and you know what? And by the end of the article, which most people don't read to the end of the article, you could throw in there that big household income was the biggest contributor to the Black-White achievement gap. And Johnny, as you point out too, how many people listening right now are going, duh, we already knew this. It's like, yeah, you know, and that's why we're putting it out there, though, too, is to say, though, our advocacy and the continuing talking about this and laying out the realities that these are the things that truly affect academic achievement. If you really are concerned about students doing well in school, hey, now, finally, after 40 years of yelling that poverty don't matter, the reality is that poverty does matter. We have been saying that for going on 40 years now. In fact, the advocacy that we have been putting out there, I would take this as an accomplishment that we have finally pushed an organization like the Fordham Foundation to actually square with the true research and the research findings out there that says, hey, when you're dealing with academic achievement, you got to look at household income. And man, guess what? One of their other recommendations, though, too, boy, I mean, talk about a big one, but early childhood education should be well funded. Yeah, just
what? Walk. Really? What?
Yes. Old news, man. Hey, and when it's cold outside, you may be cold. And when it's hot outside, you may experience heat. You stand in the rain, you might get wet.
It's one of those. Yes.
Fordham Institute.
One of those. We put it out Brilliant there. So, yeah,
you invest in children and their well-being, and they grow up to be, they have a better chance of being well-adjusted, contributing members of a democracy. Fancy that.
Incredible.
Well, and in fact, Johnny, that is one of the insights in there, too, is that the investment that you have pointed out many times, that the reason we're doing these things are the investments early on, and we know they pay off in the long run. So guess what? An investment in early childhood education, early childhood interventions. Now, they don't go in, besides the early childhood education, they don't talk about the early childhood interventions that we might point out that would be, you know, like you said, access to food, healthy food. That would be something also that is, you know, maybe part of high quality early childhood education. Maybe not. We don't know. Maybe if you're in Minnesota and part of the governor there, who's now the vice presidential candidate for the Democrats, Tim Walz, where they said, you know, they're not banishing books in Minnesota. They're banishing hunger, free breakfast and lunch for those kids. Because guess what? That issue, that economic condition, hunger, big contributor to the academic achievement gap. So we're going to go after that. Healthcare, yeah. Shelter, all of these issues that may or may not necessarily be included in early childhood advocacy. Because, and this is where, again, so Fordham, if you're saying that all kids need access to, quote, preschool with an academic curriculum, I'm not so sure that that's exactly what your research is saying. Your research is saying poverty, anti-poverty issues connected to early childhood education. Because, Johnny, there's actually a pretty good amount of research out there that early childhood education without the intervention of poverty reduction actually doesn't go that far. It doesn't go that far because it just doesn't, because we go back to the just the number one idea, the hierarchy of needs, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. When you need food, shelter, healthcare, and clothing to actually survive in this world, survive. That's just to survive in this world. Then you want to start moving up to the thriving categories of Maslow's hierarchy. Well, you got to do a little bit more, but to get up there to that learning, that self-actualization, you got to have things like food, healthcare, hunger, shelter, all of those things. So Fordham, okay, we got it there. One more other trending news issue here as we're coming up on this. So Johnny, back up in our wheelhouse. This has been a bit of a social studies day right here. But guess what? One of the better ways to actually teach kids how to think critically, they can actually get into a discussion of where did this history content come from? So in other words, why do we learn about Martin Luther King last year? And why is this year Martin Luther King Jr. considered a controversial subject? Hey, let's study how history standards are made, because that might actually give us into insight. Makes me ask the question, though, would that be considered a subversive activity, actually teaching why Martin Luther King didn't make the cut? Hey, we'll figure it out more. Hold on.
Fox reports, boys in the rich.
We call it America, whoa. 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 We call it America.
There it is. Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk, educated educators talking education. Number is 855-752-4842. It is a Monday. Yeah, man, we're back, you know. Hey, Democratic National Convention. You know, yeah, there was still a lot there. You're always welcome to call in and talk about that some more, but we're moving forward here. Jumped in, though, the beginning of the show, Electoral College moving into, hey, guess what? Poverty matters. And we found that out, that poverty actually has always mattered. But it is nice to see.
And you know what? We've been talking a lot about before the DNC, and it came up some through that. So we can do background, but we are talking a lot about, the second Bill of Rights, or, you know, understanding like a FDR kind of commitment to eliminating poverty and really, you know, making this a place for people to have sort of not so low of a floor. Come on, man. Like, it shouldn't be easy to fall off. Well, as you know, listener, it's not easy to stay not falling off in this country. It's hard to make ends meet. There was a day, like, you know, the generation ahead of me would tell me, oh, you know, well, you should take certain percentage of your paycheck, put it here and save it and all this. And, you know, I was like, when I grow up, I'm going to do that. Well, most of the grownups I know are pretty much paycheck to paycheck in this country, some even thinner than that. And you know what? That's very different than the experience of past generations. And that is not because generation says, hey, let's make it harder on these kids. We neglected to think about how hard it is to make ends meet in this country. And we've accepted that to varying degrees. Mm. So I like this movement of an indignance to that condition. I like that young people are saying, you know what? No way. Enough. We need to be better. We need to do better. And so I'm optimistic, Tim. But it reminds me of like that commitment to human rights, that second Bill of Rights we talked about a couple of weeks ago. We brought it up a lot. an FDR-esque agenda. You're getting at that, like the Kamala Walls ticket has that. There are lots of local elections that resonate, right, with those sounds. How do we make this country livable for everybody, right? Not just for some, not just for the people who have the most money or who were born into, you know, economic security, but for the majority, everybody who ought to be able to have those base needs met. Like you said, when we teach about what is we teach a science lesson, like what's habitat, food, water, shelter, space, right? Nothing radical, nothing leftist about that. Food, water, shelter, shelter, space. The squirrel, what's the squirrel's food, water, shelter, space? Right. In early elementary, we teach about habitat and science.
The squirrel. Well,
let's talk about that habitat in our communities, right? Food, water, shelter, space.
Those
four things that are essential to our living that are some of the most expensive and unaffordable things in our community. Food, water, shelter, space. Okay. So I want to get back to those things. Let's really dial in on those, Tim. But you know what? We have a theme. 20th century last week's theme, right? I liked it a lot. Contribute to good causes, right? We're doing it for the cause. Well, hopefully you're supporting your vote, your local folks running for election. So it's elections on the air. So that's a no-brainer. Get out there, support those causes. But also, Tim, what kind of print news do you get? Where do you get your information from, right? How do you contribute to good causes? The journalists, the writers, the people who are out there truth-telling, right? So looking to find facts. You were talking about teaching history, right? And the importance of bringing facts into our classroom. Where do you get your facts from? Where do we get our information? Where do we get diverse perspectives that are real and honest? Contribute to good causes. I know one for me, Tim, I'll share.
Okay.
Schools.
There you go.
Always working on being a better teacher and sharing that with other teachers. For me, the cause, right, is justice. I like that cause, justice, and rethinking schools. They're providing, you know, print resources I can have in my classroom. I can look at, I can read. We're not sponsored by them. This is a non-sponsorship plug. Really, I'm just actually sharing.
No, that's
one of my causes. I really look to that. Tim, what's great. One of yours?
Yeah, it's a great cause. Well, if you're talking about too, where do you get that information? And one of the things I do is that I actually have, you know, I do the intentional multiple source looking at, and you know, along with CNN, MSNBC. Guess what? I don't know that this is as much as contributing to a cause, but I do pull up those other ones, Fox News occasionally, because I need to get that sense of realizing how we're going to put together a conversation. But you know what? Independent journalism, though, too. I've got quite a few Substack, subscriptions.
I'm going to ask you to share those with our listeners this week, Tim, because I myself need to know a few more of them.
Yeah. Well, I point out one right now. One a great guest on our show, John Warner, who's been on very often, you know, talking about writing. But I mean, again, his independent journalism right there. And so can you contribute to those authors out there who are digging deep to find information that isn't going to make K-12 dive or CNN or anything like that? Doesn't mean
bad places to get.
No, it doesn't mean that. But it means that there is a lot of great stuff out there, you know, and say, guess what, too? You know what? You want to know a good cause? Listening to Busted Pencils, Johnny, every night, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, downloading the Civic Media app, making sure that you're always informed, taking the Busted Pencils podcast and sharing that with your neighbors. That's contributing to a good cause, Johnny Lupinacci.
Yeah, speaking about a good cause and really good, strong effort coming out of your old neck of the woods, man, we got a banger of a show tomorrow, Tim. Who do we got tomorrow?
Hey, man, check it out, though. We've been, you know, really saying national teacher shortage. We say it's a teacher exodus. What can you do? We started this way back 3 years ago talking to Austin Peay State University in Tennessee, their Grow Your Own program, teacher apprenticeship. Man, it's catching fire. Edgewood College in the city of Madison, Wisconsin. Edgewood College in the city of Madison, Wisconsin, together with Madison Metropolitan Schools, has put together a Grow Your Own partnership where they are looking at saying, guess what? Our teachers, they already work for the school district. We just need to give them the access. How does that happen? Hey, We got the Edgewood College Madison Metropolitan School District people tomorrow night, Busted Pencils, talking about growing their own teachers. Tune in tomorrow. Johnny Lupinacci, Jess, you guys are awesome. Fire!